All right, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, and it's September 15th. And let's see, starting next week on Wednesday is practicum number two. So Monday's group, they don't have a practicum, but Wednesday's group does have a practicum already. So Monday then is the following Monday. And we started talking about bones last time. We looked at some general features of bones, so we're going to continue that today. But we're going to talk specifically about some bones. And remember, at least in lab we mentioned that, if we look at the screen on the right-hand side you see a skeleton, and we can break all the bones on the skeleton down into two main categories. And you can see the main colors right here, right? The gray colors versus the like beige-colored bones. Right, and the two main categories would be the axial skeleton, made up of bones of the head, vertebral column, and the thoracic cage. That's the axial skeleton. And then the second designation would be the appendicular skeleton. Those are bones of the upper appendage and lower appendage, and also the girdles that help attach the appendicular bones to the axial skeleton, like the pelvic girdle right here, and the pectoral girdle up on the superior margin of the thoracic cavity. All right, so today we're going to look at some of the bones of the axial skeleton, which is the first thing that we looked at in lab as well. All right, but before we start talking about bones, if we look over here on the left-hand screen, we have some nomenclatures, right? Some names of different kinds of landmarks that we find on bones. And this terminology is a little bit different than what you use in everyday life, so let's just go over some of the terminology. So when I use these terms, you know what the heck I'm referring to. Okay, so we've got maybe four general kinds of landmarks. The first one is a rough spot, and it's a raised area on the bone. So it's going to be poking off the bone a little bit, and it's going to be rough because dense connective tissue attaches to that part of the bone. So that could either be a tendon or a ligament. In most cases, it's a tendon that attaches a muscle to a bone, and that muscle is pulling on the bone all the time. That makes the bone just bigger and stronger in that location. So it's a raised area on a bone. The second is a depression, right? And that's for holding something. The third thing is going to be a hole in a bone. That's a passageway for something. And the fifth thing is going to be a smooth articulating surface on a bone. And that could be a raised area, or it could actually be a depression. But if it's smooth, it's not for muscle attachment or ligament attachment. It's for bones sliding past each other so they don't grind each other away. That's going to be an articulation. All right, so let's go over some of these things in particular. All right, a raised rough spot. Generally, we call that a process, right? And that's for muscle attachment, but it could go by other names that some of us are looking at in lab already. Tubercle is another name for a process, or a tubercle is a process. All right, so what's the function of a tubercle? Would be the same as for a process, which is muscle attachment, right? Okay. A tuberosity is the same thing. It's a rough raised area on a bone. It is a process, again, for muscle attachment. Some of the biggest processes are the trochanters on the thigh bone or the femur. Those are trochanters. Epicondyles are areas that are superior to a condyle, a condylar surface. All right, then we've got a malleolus that we have on our tibia and fibula. And a crest is a process, but it's really long and narrow, so it has a little bit different shape. A spine is a process, all right, but it's long and pointy. It's not long along the length of the bone. It's actually pointing a long distance out away from the bone. And a line is a process that's not very large, but it extends over a long section of the bone. So these are all for muscle attachment. All right, a depression is for holding something, and it goes by different names, like a fossa is a bowl, like the anterior cranial fossa that will look like. It holds the anterior parts of the brain and the middle cranial fossa, the middle parts. All right, and we looked at the glenoid fossa today in lab. That's a part of the scapula. It's a depression that holds the head of the humerus in the shoulder joint. A groove is a depression, but it's long and narrow. So maybe that costal groove, y'all have looked at a rib on the inferior medial margin of a rib, there's a groove which blood vessels go through. It's a depression, and it's just a spot for maybe nerves or blood vessels or even muscle tendon to pass through. And an alveolus is a socket. Sometimes they're kind of round shaped, but it's just going to be a pocket or a spherical shaped spot in a bone. And again, that's for holding something. I'll point those out. A hole is used as a passageway. There's a couple different names for holes. The most common one is foramen. So a foramen is a very short hole in a bone. Maybe it's a hole that's going through a thin part of the bone, so it's not very long. A meatus is a hole in a bone that doesn't go all the way through. We're going to see a meatus in the temporal bone, where there is like a tunnel that goes into the temporal bone that allows sound energy to enter the temporal bone, where you have the apparatus for hearing. A canal is a foramen, but it's going through a thick part of the bone. So it's not just a hole that you have punched in a piece of paper for your binders, right? But it actually looks more like a tunnel. It's going through a thick part of the bone. And as a matter of fact, a canal can kind of curve around inside the bone as well. So you can't maybe even see all the way through it like you can a foramen because of that curvature. A fissure is a hole, but it's very long, right? It's a very long, it's not oval, it's not circular. It's, kind of maybe looks like a slit going through a bone. And a sinus, right, that's a cavity. That could be a hole inside the bone which doesn't communicate with the outside of the bone, but there is just a space inside the bone that doesn't communicate on the outside one way or the other, and that's what we call a sinus. There are a number of different kinds of sinuses in the body, but since we're talking about bones, we'll look at some paranasal sinuses. All right, then we've got some smooth parts of bones, right? And those are going to be mostly covered, or most of the time will be covered with hyaline cartilage. These are for joints. So these are where places where bones move up against each other and maybe slide over each other or rotate against each other or hinge one way or the other. And so those smooth places on bones, and they might be a raised area or a depression, we call them condyles. Right, and the head of the radius, or the head of the femur, is an articulating surface. A facet is a condylar surface that's not raised, but it's a depression. Right, we see facets on thoracic vertebrae, for instance. And a couple others, right here, trochlea is a special articulating surface on the humerus. And actually, there's another one right here that's a nice companion term, is the capitulum. That's an articulating surface as well, right next to the trochlea on the distal epiphysis of the humerus. Now, when I say distal epiphysis, does that mean anything to you guys? I think we talked about that last time. Yeah, that's the end of a long bone that's far away from the attachment point to the rest of your body, right? That the one that's closest to the attachment point to the rest of your body would be the proximal epiphysis. So if we look at the slide on the right and we look at the humerus right here, this end of the humerus is the proximal epiphysis, and then this is the distal epiphysis down over here by the elbow. And what do we call that part of a long bone that's between the epiphyses? That's the diaphysis. Yeah, so that's just a little review from last time. A few bones have a feature called a ramus, and a ramus is an area of a bone. Maybe on the right-hand side, we can look at the mandible right here. This is the body of the mandible. And we can see that it makes like a 90-degree turn, and it moves up toward the temporal bone. This is what we call the mandibular ramus. So ramus is a section of bone that's at a 90-degree angle to the major body of the bone. And there's a couple bones that have a ramus. Another one would be down here in the pelvic bone. I see a nice 90-degree bend here, and there's another 90-degree bend up over here on the pubic bone. Those are all called rami, or singular for ramus. All right, so now I can start to use some of that terminology effectively. And remember that we can break the skeleton down into two main areas if we look on the slide on the left. We've got the axial skeleton, which is what we're going to talk about today. And then the second division would be the appendicular skeleton, which we'll talk about next week. All right, the axial skeleton is made up of the skull, and you don't have to know the numbers of bones, I just put them in there for fun, but there are 28 different bones in the skull. You do have to know them, you just don't have to know that there's 28 of them, right? And some of them come in pairs, so it's really not 28 separate bones. Like, for instance, from lab, anybody give me an example of a bone that comes in pairs? Okay, in the skull in particular. Parietal, yeah, you got two parietal bones. And give me an example of a bone that is just singular, you only have one of. Frontal, yeah, frontal, mandible, hyoid bone, for instance. Those just come by themselves. Oh, and I pulled a hyoid bone out by itself because that's really kind of an odd bone. It doesn't really articulate with any other bone in your body, but it's suspended by muscles inside the mandible. And it kind of looks like the mandible, but of course it's much smaller. All right, the other part of the axial skeleton would be the vertebral column and the thoracic cage. And if we look on the slide on the right over here, we can see that the axial skeleton is in this gray color, right? We got the skull bones, the vertebral column, and then the thoracic cage. All right, so let's move on to the skull. So these are really good bones in the skull that you should be familiar with. And the skull bones can be broken down into two categories as well. There are bones that make up the face. We call those facial bones. And then there's bones that house the brain, that armor the brain, that protect the brain from trauma. And those we call cranial bones. So let's go look at a good picture, a good exam figure, okay, of the cranium would be, this nice lateral view right here. So you should be really familiar with this diagram because you've even been tested in lab on this one. But basically, we got what? A frontal bone. And in lab, I mentioned it's really a good idea to pay close attention to bones and learn them very well because you learn so much other anatomy that's associated with bones. For instance, there's a part of the brain just underneath the frontal bone that's called the frontal lobe, right? So now you know some neuroanatomy as well, right? So frontal bone, and then we got parietal posterior to it, occipital, and then you know the name of the lobe of the brain in this region right here. That would be the occipital lobe. So when we get to the brain, the only thing you have to then learn is what is the function of the occipital lobe? What's the function of the parietal lobe? Right? We'll give you some functions of those different lobes. All right, now most of the bones in the cranium, so these are all cranial bones that protect the brain. They're flat bones, and they develop from intramembranous ossification, right, including this temporal bone right here. And indeed, this region of the temporal bone is called the flat region. And what is the anatomic name for flat? Squamous, yeah. So this is the squamous region of the temporal bone right here. All right, so these are all cranial bones along with the sphenoid. The sphenoid goes all the way from the right side of the head over to the left. It helps make the posterior part of an orbit. So these eye sockets right here is just another name for an orbit. And we would find the sphenoid bone back in there. All right, very prominent bone, but actually if we look at it, the skull bone is disarticulated. It's kind of a small bone compared to the rest, but it's a very prominent facial feature. This is the zygomatic bone, and it doesn't make up the cranium, so this is a facial bone, along with the mandible, the lower jawbone right here, and the maxilla, the upper jawbone. Nasal bone is a facial bone. The lacrimal bone is a facial bone as well. And of all these bones that we look at, there's only one that moves. All the rest are held together very tightly by these joints that we call sutures. These are fibrous joints that hardly move whatsoever, right, after you're born, at least 2 years after the parturition. Okay, oh, what was my question that I talked over? I wanted to ask you a question. Oh, what's the only bone that moves? Good question. What's the only bone that moves in the head? And that is the mandible right here, and the joint that moves is the temporomandibular joint. So it's a joint between the condylar surface, or the condyle of the mandible, and the condylar notch of the temporal bone. And that's kind of a joint, that's kind of a complicated joint. It has some similarities to your knee, believe it or not, because your knee has a meniscus, and there's also a fibrocartilage meniscus in the temporomandibular joint as well. And that causes some major problems for people unfortunately, if they've received trauma to their jaw laterally, right, disturbing that particular joint. Sometimes we just call that the TMJ, for temporomandibular joint. Okay. Well, what are some other features of the skull right here? Well, here's a process, right? What's the function of this process right here? Muscle attachment, right? So this is the mastoid process behind your earlobe. Here is a styloid process because it looks like the tip of a pen or a feather that people used to write with. All right. The coronoid process on the mandible. And again, these are all for muscle attachment. But the styloid process also has ligaments attached to it, and a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection as opposed to a tendon, which is a muscle-to-bone attachment. But you should realize that those attachments are very, very similar. Okay, let's go over some of the nomenclature on how we name certain landmarks on bones. Here is a process that's coursing anteriorly from the temporal bone. And we don't call that the temporal process, even though it's a part of the temporal bone. It is moving anteriorly and articulating with the zygomatic bone. So we name a process, in this particular case, after the bone that it articulates with. All right, so here is a process on the temporal bone. It articulates with the zygomatic bone, so we call that the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. So we name it after the bone that it touches. All right. Similarly, here is a process on the zygomatic bone. It's not labeled on this diagram, but now you know how to label it. Right? You don't label it by the name of the bone. You name it by the bone that it is articulating with. So this would be the temporal process of the zygomatic bone, for instance. All right. Here's another process on a zygomatic bone. What bone is that touching? The frontal bone. So what would you call this process right here? That's the frontal process of the zygomatic bone, or sometimes the zygomatic bone is called the zygoma. That's a little bit of an archaic term, but you might hear that. Okay, and what about this process right here? How would you name that process? That is the maxillary process of the zygomatic bone because it's touching the maxilla right here. Okay, so we also have some foramina. Here is the mental foramen because this is the mental region of the mandible. All right, here's the infraorbital foramen. There is also sometimes a supraorbital foramen because the orbit is also called the eye socket right here. The orbit or eye socket is the same thing. And then here is that hole in the temporal bone that doesn't go all the way through, so we call that a meatus, and this is the external acoustic meatus that allows us to hear things. All right, so let's look at a little bit different perspective of this skull. Oh, you do have to know sutures, right? I kind of skipped over sutures. Let me go back. Like the coronal suture, that's pretty easy to see, right, because that's just right on the coronal plane. And then the squamosal suture right here because it's in the squamous region of the skull. Lambdoid suture. And I think maybe those are most of the ones that I want you to know. Otherwise, for instance, if we look at this suture between the nasal bone and frontal bone, we could name it after the bones that form that suture, as long as we do what to those two words, the nasal bone and frontal bone. That would, yeah, you put an O, so that would be the nasal frontal suture. All right, so here we have the occipital mastoid suture because it's close to this mastoid region right here. All right, so you guys actually know quite a bit. This tiny little bone right behind the frontal process of the maxilla, that's the lacrimal. That's a very, very thin bone. There is a duct that moves through, or there is a foramen that moves through the lacrimal bone that can carry tears from your eye, okay, into your nasal cavity. There's a lacrimal duct. So that's why, for instance, when you're teary-eyed, your nose starts to run as well, because tears not only run down your face, but they also run into your nose through that little duct. And then behind the lacrimal gland is an ethmoid bone, which I'll talk some more about in just a little bit. All right, so here are these sutures again, the lambdoidal suture, sagittal suture. That's an easy one to remember, right, because it's right on the sagittal plane. And then there are a number of very nondescript bones that can develop within a suture, right, that we see right here. Here are two of them, and notice on the other side we don't see them. It goes by different names. Sometimes we call those sutural bones. But because these sutures are highly irregular, right, kind of looks like a worm crawling around, right? We call these Wormian bones as well. So Wormian bones are sutural bones that are formed completely within a suture in the cranium. All right, so here's a pretty good aspect to see. All right, so we got frontal bone, nasal bone, maxilla, and zygomatic over here. So here we see that infraorbital foramen, the supraorbital foramen, which is just a notch in many, many people. It doesn't move all the way to the superior orbital margin on the frontal bone. All right, so then you would just call it a notch. Here's that mental foramen again. And the bones that we haven't really pointed out before, all right, here is the sphenoid on the right, here is the sphenoid on the left, but you can also see the sphenoid making up the posterior orbital cavity right here. And you can see the optic canal, the superior optical fissure, the inferior fissure here, I mean orbital fissure, which are part of the sphenoid bone. And looking inside the nasal cavity, okay, anytime we have tissue that separates a cavity into two different locations or two different parts, right, like this wall right here, we call that a septum. All right, so that septum separates the nasal cavity into the right and left divisions right there. That's important because it helps order air as it's flowing into your lungs so that it's nice and laminar, so that it flows smoothly through your nose, as opposed to being turbulent, having a lot of eddy currents, which then would make it very hard to breathe. All right, the nasal septum is made out of two bones. The inferior one is what we call the vomer, and it just kind of looks like a knife blade if you look at it in lab. And the top part right here is just part of the ethmoid bone. So the ethmoid bone has got to be probably my favorite bone of the skull because it does so many interesting things. So the first thing that it does is that it helps allow you to breathe easy because it helps make up the nasal septum. The ethmoid bone also has some of these shelves in it that we call nasal conchae. These also help order air as you breathe in so that it's not turbulent, so that it's easy to breathe. But there's a nice mucous membrane on these nasal conchae right here, which help humidify the air before it gets into your lungs so you don't turn your lungs into potato chips, right? And if it's really hot outside, these nasal conchae cool the air down because it has a nice vascular supply. Or if it's cold outside, it does what to the air? Yeah, like if you live in North Dakota and it's minus 14 degrees outside, if you were to inhale that kind of air into your lungs, you could possibly freeze your lungs even. So these nasal conchae air condition the air so it's more proper for your lungs. There's an inferior bone. That's a bone all by itself. It's not part of the ethmoid bone, but the middle, and there's a superior one that we can't see that are a part of the ethmoid bone. All right, so you see the middle nasal conchae right here, and this perpendicular plate helps make up the nasal septum. Okay, I think that's all I want to say about that diagram right there. I don't make a really big deal out of the inferior view, okay, of the skull. You might want to look at it. Well, here's a good perspective for you to have. All right, so we're missing a bone. What bone are we missing from this perspective? Yeah, the mandible is gone. It's been reflected away so that we can see the upper jawbone, which is the maxilla, right? And you can see all of the teeth. And of course, you have two maxilla. And here's the intermaxillary suture. And here's the incisive foramen. There's a little foramen right there because these teeth are your incisors. All right, so if you couldn't find that in lab, that's where you want to look for it. All right, the bone that makes up the nasal septum below the ethmoid is the vomer. You can see a little bit of the vomer, but this is what I was trying to get at. Here is a bone that we haven't seen yet. It helps make up the nasal cavity, and it's kind of like an L-shaped bone, and it fits in your nasal cavity like this. There are two of them, okay, and it's called the palatine bone. And what we're looking at right here are the horizontal plates of the palatine bone, right? That would be my thumbs of the palatine bone, and that helps make up something that we call the hard palate. The hard palate of the roof of your mouth is actually hard, bony tissue. These two plates are part of the maxilla. These are the palatine processes because they are articulating with what bones? The palatine bones right here, right? So, and these horizontal plates of the palatine bone, right? Sometimes you could actually call them the maxillary process of the palatine bones, but usually we just call these the horizontal plates of the palatine bone. This thing you should recognize, of course, that's easy, as the foramen magnum, passageway for spinal cord. And the other thing, maybe these things right here, these are smooth articulating surfaces. What's a nice general name for a smooth articulating surface on a bone? That would be called a condyle, right? So these are the occipital condyles for articulating with the first cervical vertebrae. All right, so that's probably all I want to say about that diagram right there. All right, but you also have to be aware of some disarticulated bones, and probably you can recognize this one pretty easily as being the temporal bone, right? Nice zygomatic process, mastoid process, styloid process, external auditory or acoustic meatus. Okay, and for practicing recognizing the disarticulated bones, you have that video in Blackboard, okay, which just goes over these bones over and over and over again, which is a flash quiz. If we have time, maybe we can take a look at that today. All right, now here is an important perspective of the cranial vault that you should be aware of. I don't know if this is an exam figure, but this is going to really help you for the lab practicum. It shows the foramina, okay, as well as some of the fossas in the cranium. So here's the anterior cranial fossa. Here's another depression which is separate from the anterior. This is the middle cranial fossa, and then here's the posterior cranial fossa. And this right here is that sphenoid bone that moves all the way from the right, left side of the head. And here is a nice depression for holding the pituitary gland. Sometimes the pituitary gland is called the hypophysis, meaning below the hypothalamus. When we look at the brain, that might make a little bit more sense to you. But the pituitary gland sits right in this depression. And remember, a name for a depression is a fossa for holding something. But this one is so special because it holds that special endocrine gland. We give it its own name, and it reminded somebody of a saddle you would put on a horse to ride a horse, and in particular, a saddle from Turkey. They had very particular stylistic kind of saddle, and so it's called the sella turcica, this depression that holds the pituitary gland. Okay, so all these foramina you're going to be tested on in lab, right? So for instance, in the ethmoid bone right here, these are the olfactory foramina. That's what olfactory nerves move through down into the nasal cavity, then the optic canal. And I like to start anteriorly and move your way back posteriorly, ending up with the foramen magnum right here. So we got olfactory, optic canal, rotundum, ovalis, spinosum, lacerum, and then right across from the external acoustic meatus, you got the internal acoustic meatus, but that's not a canal that is continuous through the temporal bone. It stops because in this region right here, you have a number of very sophisticated apparatuses for hearing as well as maintaining balance. So we'll look at those when we get into the senses chapter. So this is a relatively thick area of the temporal bone, and we call that the petrous region of the temporal bone, petrous region. That's in your lab book. All right, and then we have a really big hole right here. That's the jugular foramen. And, of course, the jugular vein moves through the jugular foramen. That's the vein that drains all the blood back from your brain to the rest of your body, back to your heart. Foramen magnum, and then on either side of the foramen magnum is the hypoglossal canal. Okay, so this is a particularly good aspect to look at the bones that make up the cranium. Right here. All right, so here's a disarticulated bone. You should recognize that right away as sphenoid bone. All right, a little bit different view of the sphenoid bone. This major region right here, that's the body. Inside the body, there is a big cavity. There is a paranasal sinus. And guess what the name of that paranasal sinus is? That's the sphenoid paranasal sinus. And it's filled with lymphatic tissue, so it helps fight infection because we're breathing in bacteria all the time. It keeps us from getting sore throats and nasal infections and things like that. These bony plates that are poking straight inferiorly from the sphenoid bone. All right, so here's the sphenoid. What do you think is below the sphenoid bone? Can you kind of picture a skull? And what would be below this area? All right, so here's the ethmoid. We got the nasal cavity right there. All right, and so here's the anterior cranial fossa. Here's a little bit deeper fossa. This is the middle cranial fossa. So that sits lower in your head. So it's almost at the level of the nasal cavity, more the level of your mouth. Okay, so these processes are poking more down by your mouth, and indeed, what's the function of a process? Muscle attachment, right? So there are important muscles that attach here and also to the mandible that articulate the mandible. And since you know the name of this process, the pterygoid process, we don't pronounce the P, you also know the names of those muscles, more or less. Those are the pterygoid muscles that attach there that allow you to grind food back and forth. Okay, so from that standpoint, I think it's a good idea if you know these are the pterygoid processes, or you could call them pterygoid plates if you want to. All right, so on this view, we see some pretty good aspects of the skull, for instance, the mandible. And don't forget, on the anterior side of the mandible, there are a couple foramina called the mental foramina on either side. Here's another important foramen back over here in the mandibular ramus. Now, this is on the medial aspect of the mandibular ramus, so it's on the inside of the mandible. This is the mandibular foramen. So don't confuse mandibular foramen with mental foramen, and that's a passageway for arteries as well as nerves. Okay, in there, and that's the nerve that gets anesthetized when you have your teeth worked on by your dentist. So you're maybe familiar with that little nerve. Here's that sphenoid bone. Here are the sphenoid sinuses. Here's the nasal septum. The superior part of the nasal septum is the ethmoid bone. The inferior part is this long, narrow bone. That's the vomer. And what we can't see in the ethmoid bone is that it's loaded with sinuses as well. So not only does the sphenoid bone have paranasal sinuses, so does the ethmoid, which gives the ethmoid bone another function. It helps you from getting sore throats and from getting sick. All right, so it helps you breathe. It's got those olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate, so allows you to smell. It's got this little process right here. We call this the crista galli. That's what a very important membrane that surrounds your brain attaches to. So the ethmoid bone also kind of holds your brain in place, so it doesn't slosh around when you're turning your head, right? Or skateboarding or windsurfing or whatever we like to do. Okay, so that ethmoid bone provides all those important functions. All right, so here's the hard palate once again. All right, so here is part of the maxilla. Here's that incisive foramen. And then posterior to this palatine process of the maxilla is actually the palatine bone. All right, so it makes the posterior floor of the nasal cavity, but it also has vertical plates that make the walls of the nasal cavity as well. Okay, really good picture of the ethmoid. You can see the paranasal sinuses now, the perpendicular plate that makes the nasal septum, the cribriform plate that has olfactory foramina, and that crista galli that helps hold your brain in place. That's a nice bone. Probably you have to know everything on this slide of the mandible, right? We said mental foramen, mandibular foramen, the coronoid process, and then here is an articulating surface. What do we call an articulating surface? That's a condyle, right? So here's the mandibular condyle, the body, the ramus, and then the mandibular angle between the ramus and the body of the mandible. Okay, nice maxilla. I don't know if this anterior nasal spine is on your lab manual. It might be, but you can see it clearly on this photograph of the maxilla. Now, the maxilla is interesting because it also has a large cavity inside of it. What did we call those cavities in facial bones or cranial bones? The paranasal sinuses. Again, that's filled with lymphatic tissue that helps fight infection. And then here is the floor of the orbit. We just call that the orbital plate or orbital surface of the maxilla. And the other bones that have these orbital surfaces would be the frontal bone has an orbital surface, and the zygomatic bone has an orbital surface as well that helps complete the orbit. Okay, I don't think I want to look over that slide. All right, so if we look at this, I think we're pretty much done with looking at the cranium, except for looking at those disarticulated bones, which we might see if we have time or early next time. Here are the four paranasal sinuses: frontal bone, ethmoid, sphenoid, and maxillary sinus. So these all are filled with lymphatic tissue that help fight infection. Okay. Oh, and then here's that hyoid bone that is inset into the mandible. All right, so we're ready to go to the rib cage. So if I slide the notes down a little bit, I mean the vertebral column. Okay, so here we see it's composed of a number of vertebrae, and we've got five major divisions of vertebrae, starting in the neck, that's the cervical region, right? And then inferior to that is thoracic, then down below that is lumbar, then we got sacral and coccygeal. And of course, you have to know how many vertebrae are in each division, right? At least typically, cervical division is 7, right? Why is that? Because you have breakfast at 7. Okay, that's not logical, but I made it sound funny just to help you remember, right? So have breakfast at 7, and okay, there are 7 cervical vertebrae. And these, let me ask you a question. All right, are these vertebrae typically large or small compared to other vertebrae? They're small because they're not holding up a lot of weight. They're only holding up your head. As opposed to the vertebrae way down here in the lumbar region, they're holding up really the rest of your body. So they're much more massive, right, and stronger. The next division underneath cervical are thoracic. There are 12 of them, and there's a really good reason why there are 12 of them. Okay, and you could say because you have lunch at noon, but I want to change tracks just a little bit. Indeed, you do have lunch at noon. That's an easy way to remember that you have 12 thoracic vertebrae, but they are thoracic vertebrae because you have 12 pairs of ribs. And there has to be a one-to-one correspondence of thoracic vertebrae and ribs, right? A thoracic vertebrae means that it has to have a rib attached to it. If there's a vertebrae with no rib attached to it, it can't be a thoracic vertebrae. It's either going to be cervical or lumbar. Okay. All right, and then you have the lumbar vertebrae. There are 5 of them. These are the big, massive vertebrae. And there are 5. Good way to remember that is because you have dinner at 5. Never, but close to 5. Closer than noon, closer than 7 a.m. usually. Okay, and then we have a region of fused vertebrae. This is the sacral region. It's a little bit variable, but most people have 5. And then the coccygeal region right here is a highly variable region. Some people have 3, some people have 5. A common number would be 4. Okay, we do have some curvatures that you notice, okay, in the spine. If we look from this anterior view right here, I don't see much curvature, but usually we'll see a little bit of a deviation to the right in the thoracic region, just a little bit, and that's really normal. Okay, why do you think the vertebral column might deviate to the right just slightly in the thoracic region? Because what do you have there? Yeah, you have your heart, and so there has to be room for that heart, okay, to beat up against the spinal column, and so there's usually a little bit of a deviation. But if we look at a lateral view, we see a lot of curvature. Okay, so we see the cervical curvature, and it is bending the spine anteriorly. Okay, and the reason why there's that anterior curvature in the cervical region is so that it helps balance your head over the center of your body. So it's easier in terms of your musculoskeletal system to maintain balance. So your head is held open, because remember, most of your body is where? Right over here where the cursor is moving around. So this anterior curvature places your head over where most of your body is. Then in the thoracic region, okay, there's a posterior curvature right here, and for the same reason why you had a little bend, right, in the anterior-posterior direction, this curvature in the thoracic region is doing what? It's allowing a space for your thoracic organs, like your heart and lungs. Okay? And then in the lumbar region, it's a little bit anterior again, and guess what that does? Same reason as the cervical curvature. It helps position weight over the center of mass of your body, so it's easier to maintain balance. And then in this region, which is close to the pelvic cavity, the curvature is posterior again, making room for pelvic organs, right? Like uterus and things like that, large intestines. Okay, so that's why you have these curvatures. Some to maintain balance and some to make room for organs. Okay. Okay, this figure you got to be really familiar with, which is just a typical vertebrae. The ventral part of every vertebrae is the vertebral body. That's the biggest massive part of the vertebrae right there. That's what bears all the weight. There's not a lot of muscle attachment to the vertebrae, but this the body of the vertebrae is for articulation, because between the bodies there's the intervertebral disc, which is fibrocartilage. We also see some depressions right here. Okay, these are what we call facets or demifacets. And so the head of a rib is going to articulate with this particular rib. I mean, this particular vertebrae. So if you see this facet right here on the body, and we see an articulating facet on the transverse process, you could also tell me what kind of vertebrae this is. Is this a cervical or a lumbar or a sacral, coccygeal, or what kind? It's thoracic, because these are articulating surfaces for ribs, right? And only thoracic vertebrae have ribs associated with them. All right, so this passageway right here is the vertebral foramen. And then sticking off laterally right here, we've got the transverse processes for what? Well, you see that it articulates for ribs, but in the cervical region and lumbar region, what would be the sole function of these processes? What would you say for any kind of process? Yes, muscle attachment, right? So hundreds of muscles attached to these processes, and the same thing for the spinous process, which is sticking straight posteriorly. Other important features of this vertebrae right here are the bony plates that protect the spinal cord. So that's really one of the other important features of a vertebrae, is that it's a bony armor that protects the spinal cord, because that's very delicate tissue. This part between the body and the transverse process, this is what we call the pedicle. And between a transverse process and spinous process, this is the lamina right here. All right, so that's how you would talk about it if there's a fracture in this region as opposed to this region over here. And then if we put all the pedicles together in both lamina, that forms the vertebral arch, along with the vertebral body, makes up the margins of this vertebral foramen. All right, the other things, of course, you know that above this vertebrae is another vertebrae. Below this vertebrae is another vertebrae, and not only do they articulate with each other on the bodies, they also have other articulating surfaces. So this is the superior part of this vertebrae. Here's the superior articulating process, and on the end of that is a nice superior articulating facet that articulates with the inferior articulating process of the rib above it that has an inferior articulating surface on it. So this is a nice joint. So you can see that back problems and back pain have plenty of opportunity to show themselves, because you have a lot of joints in vertebrae and a lot of muscle attachments, right? You've got this huge joint between vertebrae, you've got these articulating surfaces for ribs, you've got these smaller articulating surfaces on the articulating processes right here, and all of these can make you terribly miserable, right? And of course all of the muscles and ligaments that attach to the spinous and transverse processes as well. Okay, so it's an area that's prone to have problems. All right, most vertebrae just have, we talk about them very specifically by their number, their location from superior to inferior, and the division within the spinal cord that they exist, whether it's cervical or lumbar or thoracic, for instance. But there are two that have very special kind of structure, and they have special names. And if they have a special structure, guess what that means? They have a special kind of function as well, right? So if you change the structure of something, you change the function of it as well. C1, we call Atlas, named after that mythological god that's holding up the world. And this is C1 right here. We call that Atlas. And notice that the atlas is missing this part in the ventral part of the vertebrae, which would be the body. The vertebral body is missing in this particular vertebrae. So that means that it has, right, a very thin vertebral arch, can be easily damaged. Fortunately, a lot of times when it fractures, it can be a stable fracture. And that's really important because if somebody has a stable fracture of C1, of course you want to get them to the hospital, right? Maybe not you in particular, but educated people to the hospital before it unstabilizes and fractures and moves into the spinal cord causing paralysis or death, right? So if somebody has a cervical spine injury, never move them by yourself, right? Especially trained people only should be moving somebody with cervical spine injuries. On the other hand, this one down over here, this is what we call C2, and we see the vertebral body, and this is where the body of C1 ended up, fused to the body of C2. This is what we call the odontoid process, or the dens, and it fits right up in this location right here, and it allows for, a special articulation. Here's a nice transverse ligament, so here is C1, below it C2. And this allows the joint between C1, which is this vertebrae, and C2, which is this, with the den sticking up right here, allows for rotation, right? And that's this kind of motion, right? Everybody's least favorite kind of answer, right? The no motion, that's allowed. The motion, which is yes, is called flexion and extension. That is not allowed between C1 and C2. And if you have some significant trauma that does flex or extend the neck, that can break off the dens, right? And the dens usually proceeds right into the spinal cord, and that's usually instantaneously fatal when that happens. Okay, so the structure is really important. Now, you can flex and extend your neck, and the joint that's responsible for that is the joint between C1, okay, which is this right here, and the occipital condyles. That allows your head to rock back and forth anteriorly and posteriorly like that. All right, another nice distinguishing feature of a cervical vertebrae, notice that the spinous process is bifurcated, has these two spines coming out, okay? And even number 7, sometimes we call that the vertebral prominence, because if you run your hand down your neck, you're gonna run into a hump or a bump. And that is C7 kind of sticking way out compared to the rest of the spinous processes. The other way that you can tell a cervical vertebrae from any other kind of vertebrae is that they have what? These transverse foramina in the transverse process, which is a passageway for the vertebral artery that is taking blood to the brain. So you can imagine that's a very important artery. Here we have thoracic vertebrae. Spinous process just has one termination, it's not bifurcated, it's angled inferiorly, it's really long, and you know this is a thoracic vertebrae because I see a nice facet right here for articulation with a rib. Okay, and here's a little facet right here for articulating with the head of a rib, so that would be a nice thoracic vertebrae. And lumbar vertebrae are just huge and massive, no transverse foramina, no facets for articulating with ribs. The spinous process is pretty square, and it almost comes straight posterior from the body of the rib. I mean, the body of the vertebrae. Okay, then that takes us to the sacral region right here. We've got anterior, right, because here are anterior or ventral. These are all the vertebral bodies that have fused together. Here's a posterior view, and you can see foramina. Well, let me start here. All right, since all these vertebrae are fused together, that hole that the spinal nerves or spinal cord goes through, we don't call that the vertebral foramen. Now it's really a canal. It's an elongated foramen, so we could call that the vertebral canal, but instead, since this is the sacrum, we call that the sacral canal. So there are nerves that go through the sacral canal and then exit the sacral canal through these holes. All right, so this would be the posterior sacral foramina. And, of course, right on the other side will be the anterior sacral foramina. It looks just like one hole, but it has two different names because a nerve from the sacral canal will either exit posteriorly or exit anteriorly, right? It's not a nerve passing through the sacrum, but they're coming from the sacral canal. All right, and then you have the spinous processes that line up that make the median sacral crest. And that's pretty good for it, the sacrum. And the coccyx, I don't think we're really going to talk much about. Clinically, that's not ever really too significant. Okay, then it takes us to the thoracic cage. Okay, and Bone is in your body for support, but also protection. All right, so this thoracic cage is protecting what? Anything important? Yeah, like your heart, okay? Not only your heart, but great huge vessels, the great vessels coming off the base of the heart, it's protecting them. And of course, your lungs are very important to protect as well. Okay, so you don't have spinal cord or brain in there, but you have other very important organs. So the ribs come off of what kind of vertebrae? Like right up here? Those would be the thoracic vertebrae. And this is true. You know what I want to do first? I think I want to show you a rib first before we talk about the thoracic cage. All right, so here is a rib, typical kind of rib. Here's the head, which is a more massive part of the rib, fairly circular, and then it shrinks down into the neck, and then there is a process right here, which we call a tubercle, because it's not a really big process, but nonetheless, it's a process. Okay, and then so this rib is moving posteriorly in this direction, and then it curves around through the angle, and it courses anteriorly to where then this end right here is going to articulate with the sternum. All right, so this end articulates with the sternum via some kind of costal cartilage. So when you hear that term costal, you should think of like rib cage, something of that nature. Okay, like a costal cartilage is the cartilage in the rib. And this end articulates with a vertebrae. The head of a rib articulates with the vertebral body, and the tubercle articulates with the transverse process. All right, some other features of a rib in the angle right here. Here's a little costal groove. The blood vessels kind of move around, follow the rib anteriorly. And this margin right here is really sharp. Sometimes you can just feel that with your fingertip. All right, now let's go back to the rib cage this way. Good. All right, so here's a rib. Here's the costal end, right? Here's the costal end, and here's the costal cartilage forming the articulation between the end of the rib and the sternum. And then back over here, the first part is the head of a rib that articulates with the vertebral body. Then here's the tubercle that articulates with the facet on the transverse process. All right, so all ribs articulate with the head on the vertebral body and tubercle on the transverse process. All 12. We have 12 pairs of ribs, just like we have 12 thoracic vertebrae. But you might notice now that some ribs have a direct attachment via this costal cartilage to the sternum. All right, and any rib that has a direct attachment is what we call a true rib. And there are the superior 7 have a direct attachment. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. A direct attachment, even though the 7th rib, it's kind of extended, but it still directly attaches to the sternum. Rib number 8, notice the costal cartilage doesn't go directly all the way to the sternum. It just goes to the costal cartilage of number 7. So all ribs below number 7 are what we call false ribs because they don't attach directly to the sternum. All right, furthermore, the most inferior two, number 11 and 12, don't have any cartilage on them whatsoever. So not only are they false, we also can call those floating ribs. Right? So those 11 and 12 are floating ribs. So make sure that you can, this is an exam figure, right? So make sure you can label this diagram right here. And then that takes us to the sternum or the breastbone right here. And there are three main parts to the sternum. Superior is the mandible. The body right here, well, the middle part is the body. And the most inferior part is called the xiphoid process. Xiphoid process is the last to ossify, so it's cartilage in young people. And that joint right there, the xiphosternal joint, is pretty weak, so the xiphoid process can break off. For instance, if you're helping somebody whose heart has stopped, what can you do? Who's educated in helping somebody whose heart has stopped? Yeah, like doing CPR, you do chest compressions. That compresses the heart. There are valves in the heart so that blood can only flow in one direction. So when you squeeze the heart, blood will only go in the right direction. And what you want to do, of course, is press on the body of the sternum and not the xiphoid process, because that xiphoid process can break off and lacerate things like the liver, which is over here, might even lacerate the pericardium or the heart. And if you start cutting tissue up inside of a person, then you're not helping them as much as you could be, right? So here's a nice landmark, put a couple fingers on it and move superior to your fingers, and then you know you're pressing on the sternum for chest compressions. This joint right here, you can palpate pretty easily because there's a little bony prominence right there called the sternal angle between the body and the manubrium. And then on the manubrium, there are a couple little notches right here. This is the jugular notch, and then here's the clavicular notch, because part of the appendicular skeleton, namely the clavicle, is going to form an articulation in this region right here. Okay, so that's pretty much the thoracic cage. And the only thing that I didn't really mention too much, it was something about the intervertebral discs. Let me go back a little bit to an intervertebral disc. I saw a pretty good example right there. Okay, nice MRI. All right, so here is an intervertebral disc, and we're looking right down on the top of it. And notice that it is not it's not homogeneous from the superficial region to this deeper region right here. The cortical part of an intervertebral disc is fibrocartilage, right? It's really tough, and we call that the annulus fibrosus, right? The inner part has more of a, it's like a gelatinous pillow. It can absorb a lot of shock, but it can be damaged a little bit more easily. We call that the nucleus pulposus. And when an intervertebral disc gets damaged, maybe because you pinch it laterally, for instance, or some other kind of trauma, then the nucleus pulposus can actually break through the annulus fibrosus and move out back toward the vertebral foramen right here and block nerves as they enter and leave the vertebral column. All right, and there are both nerves for sensation and there are nerves for controlling motor functions, mobility functions in your body. And depending on which nerves are damaged, you might feel pain or you might lose motion in a limb or some part of your body depending on which nerves are actually being damaged. Right, so that's what we call a herniated disc. Okay, so what is that hole that nerves actually leave through? Let's look at this figure right here. Okay, these look like vertebrae from the lumbar region. And if we put a couple vertebrae together, right, we see an additional foramen right here between them. If we just look at an individual vertebrae, we don't really see a hole, but if we put a couple together, we see this hole where nerves can enter or leave the central nervous system or spinal cord. This is what we call the intervertebral foramen. Right, intervertebral foramen on the sides, okay, as opposed to the hole that a where's a vertebrae at? In this region up over here, as opposed to the hole right in the vertebral arch right here, which is called the vertebral foramen. So there's a difference between vertebral foramen and intervertebral foramen. Different functions, right? One is for the spinal cord and the other is for spinal nerves that are going out to the rest of your body. Okay, so I think maybe we could do a little bit of a flash quiz just for fun. So let's see what I have. Oh, wrong flash quiz. That's an old flash quiz. Here's a pretty good flash quiz. Ooh, but I want to hide this guy. I want to hide this. Okay, so we'll just look at the screen on the left over here. So let's talk about, see if we can recognize some of these bones. What's that? Hyoid bone. No, you're good. That's not, I tried to trick you. What is that? That's a vertebrae, and in particular, it's C1, and another name for C1 is atlas, right? So atlas, that's really good. Nice transverse processes, transverse foramina here and here. Okay, so atlas. And then we've got occipital bone, foramen magnum, occipital condyles right here. Okay, this one I haven't showed you except for maybe in lab. This is an L-shaped bone that helps make the nasal cavity, so, and it's called the palatine bones. Okay, so the palatine bones look like this. You put them together like that, that makes the nasal cavity. This is the perpendicular plate right here that makes the walls of the nasal cavity. These horizontal plates right here help make the roof of your mouth behind the maxilla. All right, so that's why they look like L's. Palatine bones, this L-shaped bone. All right, what's this? Axis, C2. And here is manubrium sternum xiphoid process. That's the sternum sphenoid bone. You should probably know some parts of these, like the pterygoid processes, the cella turcica. Here's the body, greater wing, lesser wing. Okay, but at least know that's a sphenoid bone. That's a vertebrae. Now, which one? Look at this right here. That's a thoracic, and over here you have another demifacet right here for articulation. Head of the rib, tubercle of the rib articulate at those locations. This one right here, ethmoid bone. Here's a olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate. Here's the crista galli, and then here are all the sinuses, the paranasal sinuses in the ethmoid bone. Maxilla, nice features on that one, but I don't want to belabor that too much. Lumbar. Oh, yeah, lumbar vertebrae. I almost said the wrong thing. Lumbar vertebrae, obviously that's lumbar. Okay. Ah, crista galli once again, cribriform plate. Here's the perpendicular plate that makes the superior part of the nasal septum. So this is ethmoid bone, and there are the ethmoid paranasal sinuses in there. So ethmoid bone, nice mandible, mental foramen, mandibular foramen, right? Body, angle, ramus, cornoid process, the condyle, mandibular notch right there. Okay. Ah, what's that? Hyoid bone. Ah, now this is that weird one. This looks like a knife blade. It's really long and narrow. It sits underneath the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid. It makes the lower part of the nasal septum, and it is the vomer. It is the vomer that makes the lower part of the nasal septum. Here we see a couple of lumbar vertebrae. Sternum, manubrium, body, xiphoid. Sometimes we have the sternal frame in there. Most people, it probably fills in already. Thoracic. Little tiny bone, it's too big to scale, but it's your cheekbone. Yeah, zygomatic bone. What kind of vertebrae is this?
Cervical.
Cervical, yeah. Bifid spinous process, transverse foramina. Temporal bone, zygomatic. Oh, look, somebody left that in there. All right, you should know all of these different things. Temporal bone. Frontal, this is the glabella. What's underneath the glabella in this region right here? The frontal paranasal sinus. Right here's the supraorbital notch. The orbital plate will be inside this orbital margin right there. All right, got 5 minutes. Don't leave. Don't leave. Don't disturb anybody. What's this? Atlas. Oh, is this number one? Number one in a number of different ways. Okay. What's this? Occipital. Palatine. C2. Axis. Sternum, sphenoid, thoracic, ethmoid, maxilla, lumbar, ethmoid, mandible, hyoid, vomer, lumbar, sternum again, thoracic, zygomatic, cervical, temporal, frontal, C1, atlas. There's some that are missing. The ones that I have online is better than this. This is missing like the nasal bones and the parietal bone. Okay, so this is, so look at the video online. All right, so where's that sign-in sheet at? You got it? Make sure that I have that, please, before you go. So that's it for today.